documents by then, the Russians would eventually find them. Major Saver appealed to Dr. Robertson, arguing that his keeping Fleischer, Riedel, and Race was the Army's last and best shot at locating the hidden V-2 documents. Ultimately, Dr. Robertson agreed. In a final appeal, Staver asked Robertson if there was anything Robertson could offer up that might help him in his search for the V-2 stash. Some clue or detail that Staver might be overlooking. Indeed, there was. Dr. Robertson's fluency in science and his familiarity with German scientific intelligence had thus far made him an extremely effective interrogator of the Nazi scientific and military elite. Wehrmacht generals, SS officers, and scientists were notoriously eager to speak with him. Listening to Staver, Dr. Robertson had an idea. He pulled a small writing pad out of his shirt pocket and looked over his notes. During an earlier interrogation of a rocket scientist named von Plutz, Robertson had gotten an interesting lead. He decided to share it with Major Staver. Von Plutz said that General Dornberger told General Rossmann, the German Army's Weapons Office Department Chief, that documents of V-weapon production were hidden in Kalewerk, salt mine, at Bleicherode, walled into one of the mine shafts, read Robertson from his notes. Robertson suggested that Staver use that information to his advantage. He agreed to leave Fleischer, Riedel, and Race with Major Staver while he headed to Garmisch-Partenkirchen to interview General Dornberger and Werner von Braun. At Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Robertson found the rocket scientist sunbathing in the Alps. This lovely Bavarian ski resort was the place where Adolf Hitler had hosted the Winter Olympics in 1936. Now, the U.S. Army had hundreds of scientists set up in a former military barracks here. The food was plentiful, and the air was fresh and clean. Mountain springtime, Dieter Hützel recalled in his memoir. Trees by now had donned their fresh, new green flowers everywhere as far as one could see from our windows and balconies. Rain was infrequent, and almost every day sunbathing was possible on a lawn-covered yard. Hützel's only complaint was that he didn't receive mail and couldn't make telephone calls. Werner von Braun, General Dornberger, and their group had been here since being transferred from CIC headquarters in Reutte. Isolated in the Alps, the two scientists had been frustrating their interrogators, stonewalling and withholding information. Dr. Robertson came to see if he could get any better information out of the scientists. Most of the rocket team was here, including the two men who had stashed the V-2 documents that Staver was now searching for, Dieter Hützel and Bernard Tessmann. Neither Hützel nor Tessmann had shared with von Braun or Dornberger the fact that they'd told Karl Otto Fleischer the location of the stash in the Dorton mine. Dornberger and von Braun were under the assumption that they held all the bargaining chips. The intelligence officer Walter Jessel had sensed something was amiss with Dornberger and von Braun, that the two rocket scientists were playing games. Control was exercised by Dornberger in the course of the PSYOS investigations, Jessel noted in one report. Dornberger's first instructions to other scientists, probably under the impression of immediate transfer of the whole group to the United States, were to cooperate fully with the investigators, Jessel explained. But as the days wore on and no deal was offered by the Allies, Jessel watched Dornberger become intractable. Sometime later, he, Dornberger, gave the word to the others to hold back on information and say as little as possible. The scientists were walking on the razor's edge. If they said too much, many of them could be implicated in the slave labor war crimes, as was the case with Arthur Rudolph, Middlework Operations Director. For Rudolph, it was best to say as little as possible. He described his time at Garmisch-Partenkirchen as enjoyable because it meant that the horrible days of fleeing were over. Years later, he described his weeks of internment in the Alps as ones where he could finally enjoy a few days of relief. But this relief was short-lived owing to his restless intellect. Rudolf demanded more of himself than a suntan, he later said. There were already rumors that the Americans would take us to the USA, so I decided I needed to learn English. Arthur Rudolph's interrogator saw Rudolf differently than he saw himself. In military intelligence documents, Rudolf was described as 100% Nazi, a dangerous type. There was a decision to be made, whether to use Rudolf as an intelligence source or to intern him for denazification and investigation into possible war crimes. Denazification was an Allied strategy to democratize and demilitarize post-war Germany and Austria through tribunals in local civilian courts, Spruchkammern, that were set up to determine individual defendants' standings. Each German who was tried was judged to belong in one of five categories or classes. 1. Major offenders. 2. Party activists, militarists, and profiteers. 3. Individuals who were less incriminated. 4. Nazi Party followers. 5. Those who were exonerated. Rudolf's interrogator did not believe a committed Nazi like Arthur Rudolf would make a viable intelligence source, and he wrote, "Suggest internment." Rudolf hoped he would be hired by the Americans. He located a murder mystery in the Garmisch-Partenkirchen library, The Green Archer, and attempted to learn English for what he believed, correctly, would be a new job. Back in Nordhausen, Major Staver was making headway. Working on the new tip from Dr. Robertson, Staver drove to meet with his new source, Karl Otto Fleischer, in the parking lot. This time, Staver had Walter Riedel with him. In the parking lot, Staver demonstratively pulled a notebook from his breast pocket, just as Dr. Robertson had done with him. Staver read aloud a narrative he'd composed, part truth, part fiction. Von Braun, Ernst Steinhoff, and all the others who fled to the south have been interned at Garmisch, Major Staver told his two prisoners. Our intelligence officers have talked to von Plutz, General Dornberger, General Rossmann, and General Kammler, Staver said, also partially true. They told us that many of your drawings and important documents were buried underground in a mine somewhere around here, and that Riedel or you, Fleischer, could help us find them, Staver said, which was made up. Staver told the men that it was in their best interest to think over their next move very carefully. They could cooperate, he said, and give up the location of the V2 documents. Or they could stonewall and risk being put in prison for withholding information. They had one night to consider the offer. Staver would meet the two men the following morning in the same parking lot at exactly 11 a.m. When Staver arrived at the rendezvous point the next day, he was disheartened to find Riedel waiting for him but not Fleischer. Even odder, Riedel said he had a message from Fleischer to pass along. Fleischer was waiting for Major Staver in Heinrode, a nearby village, with some very important news. Staver needed to travel to Heinrode, find a boarding house called the Inn of the Three Lime Trees, and ask for the concierge. Was this some kind of a trap or just another wild goose chase? Staver and Walter Riedel drove together to the Inn of the Three Lime Trees. There they met up with the innkeeper, who produced a message from Fleischer. Staver and Riedel were to walk through town, pass down a long alleyway, and head to the edge of the village, where they were to go to the home of a local priest. Staver and Riedel followed the trail, finally arriving at the priest's house. There, in flawless English, the priest told Major Staver that Fleischer would see him soon. Fleischer emerged at the top of the stairs, came down, and asked Daver to follow him outside so the two men could talk privately under an apple tree. There, in almost inaudible, somewhat apologetic tones, Fleischer admitted he had not been completely frank about the whereabouts of the V2 document stash, Staver explained. In fact, he knew where they were hidden and believed he was the only one in Nordhausen who did. But there was a problem, Fleischer said. He described to Staver how the caretaker at the mine had dynamited a wall of rubble over the entrance so no one could find them. This man was an ardent Nazi and would never turn over the documents to an American officer like Major Staver. Fleischer said he'd take Dr. Race with him to do the job. As unreliable as he was, Staver decided to take Fleischer at his word. He gave him passes that allowed for travel around Nordhausen, as well as enough gasoline to get back and forth between Nordhausen and the mine. Fleischer and Race succeeded in getting the mine's caretaker, Herr Nebelung, to cooperate. Local miners were paid by Fleischer using money from the U.S. Army to excavate through the rubble and retrieve the documents hidden in the mine. The stash was enormous, the crates weighing more than 14 tons. Only now there was a new hurdle to overcome. British soldiers were set to arrive in Nordhausen on May 27th to oversee the transition to Red Army rule. This meant that Major Staver had to get the documents out fast. The original agreement between the British and the Americans was that the two allies would share with one another everything they learned about the V-weapons. If the British found out Staver was planning to secretly ship 100 V-2 rockets back to the United States, they would likely consider it a double-cross. Major Staver needed to get to Paris. It was the only way he could obtain access to the 10-ton trucks necessary for moving such a large cache in such a short period of time. Staver assigned a colleague to oversee the Dorton mine operation, while he attempted to hitch a ride to Paris in a P-47 Thunderbolt. The pilot said it was impossible, that the Thunderbolt was a single-seat fighter. Staver said that his mission was urgent and offered to ride in the tiny space behind the pilot's seat. The pilot finally agreed. Avoiding terrible weather higher up, the men flew all the way to Paris at treetop level and arrived safely at Orly Field. Staver found a ride down the Champs-Élysées in a U.S. Army jeep. At Ordnance headquarters, he found the exact man he was looking for, Colonel Joel Holmes, sitting at his desk. As chief of the technical division, Colonel Holmes had the authority to grant Major Staver the semi-trailers he needed to evacuate the Dorton mine stash before the British and the Russians arrived. But Staver had a second plan that he had been conceiving, and, as he later explained, this moment in Paris was his prime opportunity to act. He told Colonel Holmes that there was a third element necessary to make the V-2 rocket program in America a success. Staver had been locating rocket parts and the documents necessary to assemble them correctly. But to make the rockets fly, the Americans needed the German scientists. The Army needed to bring these scientists to the United States, Staver explained. Their superior knowledge could be used to help win the war in Japan. "You write the cable and I'll sign it," Staver remembered Colonel Holmes having said. In Paris, Staver sat down and wrote a cable that would have a huge impact on the future of the Nazi scientist program. "Have in custody over 400 top research development personnel of Peenemünde, developed V2, Staver wrote. "The thinking of the scientific directors of this group is 25 years ahead of U.S., later version of this rocket should permit launching from Europe to U.S. Given the enormity of this idea in 1945, that a rocket could one day actually fly from one continent to another, Staver pushed. "Immediate action recommended to prevent loss of whole or part of this group to other interested parties. Urgently request reply as early as possible." The cable was sent to Colonel Tritchell's office at the Pentagon, and Major Staver returned to Nordhausen. the documents were loaded up and driven to Paris under armed guard. From there, they were shipped to the Foreign Documents Evaluation Center at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. Special Mission V-2 was declared a success. The U.S. Army Ordnance Rocket Branch now had 100 rockets and 14 tons of technical documents in its possession. But Staver did not view Special Mission V-2 as entirely complete. He still had his sights set on the rocket scientists themselves. With the arrival of the Soviets into Nordhausen less than 48 hours away, Staver got the approval he'd been waiting for from Scheif headquarters. He went to Garmisch-Partenkirchen, picked up von Braun, and returned to Nordhausen. The clock was ticking. Staver needed von Braun's help getting every last rocket scientist out of the Harz before the Soviets arrived. "We landed running," remembered Staver's team member, Dr. Richard Porter. Back in Nordhausen, the men got to work locating the scientists who were still living in the area. Staver had a stack of note cards with the names and addresses of the V-2 engineers. He instructed every available U.S. soldier he could find to round up anything with wheels, trucks, motorcycles, and donkey carts, and sent soldiers fanning out across the Harz. Scientists and their families were given an offer. They could be transported out of what would soon become the Russian zone, or they could stay. Arthur Rudolph's wife was in Stepferhausen, 85 miles south of Nordhausen, when a U.S. soldier arrived. "A black GI drove into town in a truck looking for me," remembered Martha Rudolph. "He had a list of names and mine was on it. He told me that if I wanted to leave to get ready, he would be back in 30 minutes to pick me up. My friends all said, 'Go, go, the Russians are coming. Why would you want to stay here?' So I packed up what I could and left on the truck when the GI came back." The Rudolph's daughter, Marianne, accompanied her to the train station. The scene at the station was surreal, recalling the horrific transport of prisoners during the war, but with the roles reversed, fate and outcome turned upside down. Over 1,000 Germans, scientists, and their families stood on the platforms waiting to fit themselves into boxcars and passenger cars. The train's engine had yet to be attached, and there was no announcement explaining the delay. Tension escalated, but the crowd remained calm until a mob of displaced persons flooded the station. Word had leaked out that German scientists were being evacuated out of Nordhausen in advance of the Red Army's arrival. Suddenly, many other locals wanted out of the Harz, too. The Red Army had a terrible reputation. There were stories of entire units arriving in towns drunk and seeking revenge. At the railroad station, U.S. soldiers were called to the scene. Using the threat of weapons, they prevented any displaced person who was not a scientist or an engineer from boarding the boxcars and passenger cars. At the 11th hour, Major Staver and Dr. Porter learned of one last potential disaster that needed to be dealt with. Right before boarding the train, General Dornberger confessed to having hidden his own stash of papers, an ace in the hole, had Dornberger been double-crossed by von Braun and left out of the American deal. General Dornberger told Major Staver that he had buried 5 large boxes in a field in the spa town of Bad Zacher. The boxes, which were made of wood and lined in metal, contained critical information about the V-2 rocket that would compromise the U.S. Army if it fell into Russian hands. In a last-ditch effort to find Dornberger's secret stash, Staver and Porter set out on a final mission. The men drove 60 miles to the headquarters of the 332nd Engineering Regiment at Kassel, where they borrowed shovels, pickaxes, 3 men, and a mine detector. Back in a large field in Bad Zacher, they searched the ground as if looking for a buried mine. Finally, they located Dornberger's metal-lined cases, which contained 250 pounds of drawings and documents. The stash was loaded onto a truck and driven to an army facility in the American zone. On their way out of the Harz, Staver and Porter passed by Nordhausen to have one last look. I wanted to blow up the whole factory at Nordhausen before we pulled out, but I couldn't swing it legally. I was afraid at the time to do the job unofficially and have regretted it ever since, Porter recalled. He was referring to the European Advisory Commission decree, signed by General Eisenhower on June 5, 1945, in Berlin, which prohibited the destruction of military research installations in another power's zone. The Soviets were now heirs to the Harz. Major Staver had succeeded in secretly shipping out enough parts to reassemble 100 V-2 rockets in America. Still, thousands of tons of rocket parts remained. For all the effort and moral compromise that went into Special Project V-2, the Red Army would now have no shortage of wonder weapons parts to choose from. The underground slave labor factory at Nordhausen was still virtually intact. Thousands of machine tools sat on the assembly lines ready to manufacture more parts. After an 11-day delay, the Russians finally arrived. Leading the pack were technical specialists from Soviet Missile Program Chief Yurgei Malenkov's Special Committee for Rocket Research. For every German scientist that had taken up the U.S. Army's offer to evacuate, between 2 and 10 remained behind. The Soviet secret police began rounding up hundreds of former rocket scientists and engineers and put them back to work. A Soviet guidance engineer named Boris Cheretok even managed to move into von Braun's old villa, the one the SS had confiscated from a Jewish businessman a few years before. Cheretok oversaw the renaming of the Nordhausen tunnel complex from the Mittelwerk to the Institut Raab, an abbreviation for Raketantrieb Bleicherode or Rocket Enterprise Bleicherode. Von Braun, 80 scientists and their families were taken to the town of Witzenhausen, 40 miles from Nordhausen in the American zone. There, they were set up in a two-story schoolhouse and paid to get to work on future rocket plans, while Army Ordnance worked on a plan to bring them to the United States, to the Fort Bliss Army Base in Texas. The Americans had been obsessed with the V-weapons during the war. Now they had the science and the scientists. In Washington, D.C., officials with the War Department General Staff remained undecided on a policy regarding what to do with Nazi scientists. General Eisenhower's questions about long-term plans had not yet been answered, and Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson was asked to weigh in. Major Staver's cable from Paris regarding the 400 rocket scientists in custody drew attention to the issue. In America, 5 Nazi scientists had already been secreted into the United States for classified weapons work. Just a few days after the German surrender, the Director of Naval Intelligence successfully lobbied the War Department General Staff to circumvent State Department regulations so that a Nazi guided missile expert named Dr. Herbert Wagner and 4 of his assistants could begin working on technology meant to help end the war with Japan. The War Department gave approval, and in mid-May, Dr. Wagner and his team were flown from Germany to a small airstrip outside Washington, D.C., inside a military aircraft with the windows blackened to keep anyone from seeing who was inside. During the war, Dr. Herbert Wagner had been chief missile design engineer at Henschel Aircraft. He was the man behind the first guided missile used in combat by the Reich, the HS-293. This remote-control bomb was the nemesis of the U.S. Navy and the British Royal Navy and had sunk several Allied ships during the war. Not only did the U.S. Navy see glide bomb technology as critically important in the fight in the Pacific, but they saw Dr. Wagner as a man with knowledge, experience, and skills unmatched anywhere in the world. The perceived importance of having Wagner's expertise in the fight against Japan was illuminated by a dramatic event unfolding in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, just as he and his team arrived. On May 15, 1945, a Nazi submarine identified in a New York Times headline as the Japan-bound U-234, surrendered itself to the USS Sutton in the waters 500 miles off Cape Race, Newfoundland. Inside the submarine, which was en route to Japan, was a cache of Nazi wonder weapons, said to contain what few aviation secrets may be left, as well as other war weapon plans and pieces of equipment. One of the wonder weapons on board was Dr. Wagner's HS-293 glider bomb, meant for use against the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. Additionally, there were drawings and plans for the V-1 flying bomb and the V-2 rocket, experimental equipment for stealth technology on submarines, an entire ME-262 fighter aircraft, and 10 lead-lined canisters containing 1,200 pounds of uranium oxide, a basic material used in making an atomic bomb. The specifics of the weapons cache were not made public, but the notion that the Nazis had sold the secrets of some of their most prized wonder weapons to their Axis partner Japan was alarming. The scenario was made even more foreboding by the fact that also on board the U-234 was a top Reich scientist whose job it was to teach Japanese scientists how to copy and manufacture these Nazi wonder weapons for themselves. The scientist in the submarine was Dr. Heinz Schlicke, director of naval test fields at Kiel. To the public, he was only identified as a German technician. In fact, Dr. Schlicke was one of the most qualified Nazi scientists in the field of electronic warfare. His areas of expertise included radio location techniques, camouflage, jamming and counter-jamming, remote control, and infrared. The Navy took Dr. Schlicke prisoner of war and brought him to the Army Intelligence Center at Fort Meade in Maryland. As for Dr. Wagner, the Navy felt it needed to keep him happy so that his work would continue to bear scientific fruit. To soften the reality of his being a prisoner, his incarceration was called voluntary detention. Wagner and his assistants required a classified but comfortable place to work, the Navy noted in an intelligence report, ideally in an ivory tower or a gilded cage where life would be pleasant, the guards courteous, the locks thick, but not too obvious. The Navy found what it was looking for in Hempstead House, a great stone castle on Sands Point on the north shore of Long Island that was formerly the home of Daniel and Florence Guggenheim. The 160-acre estate had been donated by the Guggenheims to the Navy for use as a training center. With its 3 stories, 40 rooms, and sweeping view of the sea, the Navy decided it was an ideal location. Hempstead House was given the code name the Special Devices Center, and Dr. Wagner and his assistants got to work. There were more problems afloat in Washington, this time coming from the FBI. If Nazi scientists were going to work for the U.S. military, the Department of Justice said it needed to perform background checks. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI looked into Dr. Wagner's past, based on information collected by Army intelligence in Europe, and learned that Dr. Wagner had once belonged to the German SS, the paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party run by Himmler. This meant that Wagner was an ardent Nazi. If he had stayed in Germany as a former SS member and per the laws of the occupying forces, he would have been arrested and subject to a denazification trial. But the FBI was made aware of how badly the Navy needed Wagner, and they labeled him an opportunist who is interested only in science. The FBI's bigger concern, read an intelligence report, was how much Dr. Wagner had been drinking lately. The FBI did not consider Wagner to be a drunkard, but blamed his near-nightly intoxication on the recent death of his wife. The scientist in the submarine, Dr. Heinz Schlicke, became a prisoner at Fort Meade, where it did not take long for the U.S. Navy to learn how eminently qualified he was. Soon, Schlicke was giving classified lectures on technology he had developed during the war. The first was called a general review of measures planned by the German Admiralty in the electronic field in order to revive U-boat warfare. The Navy wanted to hire Schlicke immediately, but State Department regulations got in the way. Schlicke was already in military custody in the United States as a prisoner of war. He would have to be repatriated back to Germany before he could be given a contract to work in the United States, according to the State Department. The saga of the U-234 and its passenger made one thing clear. If the War Department was going to start hiring German scientists on a regular basis, it needed to create a committee to deal with the intricacies of each specific case. Finally, on May 28, 1945, Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson weighed in on the classified subject of hiring Nazi scientists for U.S. military research. Patterson wrote to the Chief of Staff to the President, Admiral William D. Leahy, "I strongly favor doing everything possible to utilize fully in the prosecution of the war against Japan all information that can be obtained from Germany or any other source," Patterson wrote. He also expressed concern. "These men are enemies, and it must be assumed they are capable of sabotaging our war effort. Bringing them to this country raises delicate questions, including the strong resentment of the American public, who might misunderstand the purpose of bringing them here and the treatment accorded them." Patterson believed that the way to avoid foreseeable problems with the State Department, which handled visa approvals, was to involve the State Department in decision-making now. Until a new committee was formed to deal specifically with Nazi scientists, Patterson suggested that the State War Navy Coordinating Committee, SWINC, be in charge. Patterson's letter to the President's Chief of Staff, which was not shared with President Truman, prompted a meeting at the Pentagon by the War Department General Staff. The group agreed on a temporary policy. Contracts would be given to a limited number of German scientists, provided they were not known or alleged war criminals. The scientists were to be placed in protective military custody in the United States, and they were to be returned to Germany as quickly as possible after their classified weapons work was complete. A cable was sent to General Eisenhower at Scheif headquarters in Versailles, fulfilling his two-week-old request to be advised on longer-term policy. But what had been decided in Washington, D.C., had very little impact on the reality of what was going on in the European theater with scientists who had spent years serving Adolf Hitler. Chapter 7. Hitler's Doctors. During the war, physicians with the U.S. Army Air Forces heard rumors about cutting-edge research being developed by the Reich's aviation doctors. The Luftwaffe was highly secretive about this research, and its aviation doctors did not regularly publish their work in medical journals. When they did, usually in a Nazi Party-sponsored journal like Aviation Medicine, Luftfahrtsmedizin, the U.S. Army Air Forces would circumvent copyright law, translate the work into English, and republish it for their own flight surgeons to study. Areas in which the Nazis were known to be breaking new ground were air-sea rescue programs, high-altitude studies, and decompression sickness studies. In other words, Nazi doctors were supposedly leading the world's research in how pilots performed in extreme cold, extreme altitude, and at extreme speeds. At war's end, there were two American military officers who were particularly interested in capturing the secrets of Nazi-sponsored aviation research. They were Major General Malcolm Groh, Surgeon General of the U.S. Strategic Air Forces in Europe, and Lieutenant Colonel Harry Armstrong, Chief Surgeon of the 8th Air Force. Both men were physicians, flight surgeons, and aviation medicine pioneers. Before the war, Groh and Armstrong had co-founded the Aviation Medicine Laboratory at Wright Field, where together they initiated many of the major medical advances that had kept U.S. airmen alive during the air war. At Wright Field, Armstrong perfected a pilot-friendly oxygen mask and conducted groundbreaking studies in pilot physiology associated with high-altitude flight. Groh developed the original flyer's flak vest, a 22-pound armored jacket that could protect airmen against anti-aircraft fire. Now, with the war over, Groh and Armstrong saw unprecedented opportunity in seizing everything the Nazis had been working on in aviation research, so as to incorporate that knowledge into U.S. Army Air Force's understanding. According to an interview with Armstrong decades later, a plan was hatched during a meeting between himself and General Groh at the U.S. Strategic Air Forces in Europe headquarters in Saint-Germain, France. The two men knew that many of the Luftwaffe's medical research institutions had been located in Berlin, and the plan was for Colonel Armstrong to go there and track down as many Luftwaffe doctors as he could find, with the goal of enticing them to come to work for the U.S. Army Air Forces. As Surgeon General, Groh could see to it that Armstrong was placed in the U.S. occupied zone in Berlin as Chief Surgeon with the Army Air Force's contingent there. This would give Armstrong access to a city divided into U.S. and Russian zones. General Groh would return to Army Air Force's headquarters in Washington, D.C., where he would lobby superiors to authorize and pay for a new research laboratory exploiting what the Nazi doctors had been working on during the war. With the plan set in motion, Armstrong set out for Berlin. The search proved difficult at first. It appeared as if every Luftwaffe doctor had fled Berlin. Armstrong had a list of 115 individuals he hoped to find. At the top of that list was one of the Reich's most important aviation doctors, a German physiologist named Dr. Hubertus Strughold. Armstrong had a past personal connection with Dr. Strughold. The roots of that story go back to about 1934, Armstrong explained in a U.S. Air Force oral history interview after the war, when both men were attending the annual convention of the Aero Medical Association in Washington, D.C. The two men had much in common and became quite good friends. Both were pioneers in pilot physiology and had conducted groundbreaking high-altitude experiments on themselves. We had some common bonds in the sense that he and I were almost exactly the same age. He and I were both publishing a book on aviation medicine that particular year, and he held exactly the same assignment in Germany that I held in the United States, Armstrong explained. The two physicians met a second time in 1937 at an international medical conference at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. This was before the outbreak of war. Nazi Germany was not yet seen as an international pariah, and Dr. Strughold represented Germany at the conference. The two physicians had even more in common in 1937. Armstrong was director of the Aero Medical Research Laboratory at Wright Field, and Strughold was director of the Aviation Medical Research Institute of the Reich Air Ministry in Berlin. Their jobs were almost identical. Now, at war's end, the two men had not seen one another in 8 years, but Strughold had maintained the same high-ranking position for the duration of the war. If anyone knew the secrets of Luftwaffe medical research, Dr. Hubertus Strughold did. In Berlin, Harry Armstrong became determined to find him. One of the first places Armstrong visited was Strughold's former office at the Aviation Medical Research Institute, located in the fancy Berlin suburb of Charlottenburg. He was looking for leads. But the once grand German Military Medical Academy, with its formerly manicured lawns and groomed parks, had been bombed and was abandoned. Strughold's office was empty. Armstrong continued his journey across Berlin, visiting universities that Strughold was known to be affiliated with. Every doctor or professor he interviewed gave a similar answer. They claimed to have no idea where Dr. Strughold and his large staff of Luftwaffe doctors had gone. At the University of Berlin, Armstrong finally caught a break when he came across a respiratory specialist named Ulrich Luft, teaching a physiology class to a small group of students inside a wrecked classroom. Luft was unusual-looking, with a shock of red hair. He was tall, polite, and spoke perfect English, which he had learned from his Scottish mother. Ulrich Luft told Harry Armstrong that the Russians had taken everything from his university laboratory, including the faucets and sinks, and that he, Luft, was earning money in a local clinic treating war refugees suffering from typhoid fever. Armstrong saw opportunity in Luft's predicament and confided in him, explaining that he was trying to locate German aviation doctors in order to hire them for U.S. Army-sponsored research. Armstrong said that in particular he was trying to find one man, Dr. Hubertus Strughold. Anyone who could help him would be paid. Dr. Luft told Armstrong that Strughold had been his former boss. According to Luft, Strughold had dismissed his entire staff at the Aviation Medical Research Institute in the last month of the war. Luft told Armstrong that Strughold and several of his closest colleagues had gone to the University of Göttingen. They were still there now, working inside a research lab under British control. Armstrong thanked Luft and headed to Göttingen to find Strughold. Whatever the British were paying him, Armstrong figured he would be able to lure Strughold away because of their strong personal connection. There was also a great deal of money to be made pending the authorization of the new research laboratory. Armstrong and Groh's plan meant hiring more than 50 Luftwaffe doctors. There was a lot of work to be had, not just for Strughold, but for many of his colleagues as well. A great drama was now set in motion, owing to the fact that there was a second army officer also looking for Dr. Hubertus Strughold, a medical war crimes investigator and physician named Major Leopold Alexander. Dr. Strughold's name had been placed on an army intelligence list of suspected war criminals with the Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects, or CROCAS. Major Alexander was on a mission to locate him. It is not known if Armstrong was aware of the allegations against Strughold and chose to ignore them, or if he was in the dark as to Strughold's having been placed on the CROCAS list. But as Armstrong forged ahead with plans to hire Dr. Strughold and to make him a partner in the U.S. Army Air Force's laboratory, he did so in direct violation of the policy that had just been set by the War Department. German scientists could be hired for U.S. military contract work, provided they were not known or alleged war criminals. The CROCAS allegations against Dr. Strughold were serious. They included capital war crimes. The CROCAS list came out of the immediate aftermath of the German surrender, when public pressure to prosecute Nazis accused of war crimes had reached fever pitch. On May 7, 1945, Life magazine published a story on the liberation of Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen, and other death camps, complete with graphic photographs. This was some of the first documentary evidence presented to the public. When confronted by these ghastly images, people all over the world expressed their outrage at the scale of atrocity that had been committed by the Nazis. Death camps, slave labor camps, the systematic extermination of entire groups of people. This defied the rules of war. The idea of having a war crimes trial appealed to the general public as a means of holding individual Nazis accountable for the wickedness of their crimes. The group responsible for investigating war crimes was the United Nations War Crimes Commission, UNWCC, located in London and founded by the Allies in 1942. It was originally called the United Nations Commission for the Investigation of War Crimes. The War Crimes Commission was not responsible for hunting down the criminals. That job was delegated to Schaeff. The War Crimes Commission had three committees. Committee 1 dealt with lists, Committee 2 coordinated enforcement issues with Schaeff, and Committee 3 gave advice on legal points. The commission and its committees worked in concert with CROCAS, also located in Paris, which was responsible for gathering and maintaining information about suspected war criminals. After the fighting stopped, Schaeff sent war crimes investigators into the field to locate German doctors with the purpose of interrogating them. One of these investigators was Major Leopold Alexander, a Boston-based psychiatrist and neurologist and a physician with the U.S. Army. Dr. Alexander had been tending to wounded war veterans at a military hospital in England when he learned about his new assignment just 2 weeks after the end of the war. With this undertaking, his whole life would change, as would his understanding of what it meant to be a doctor and what it meant to be an American. Dr. Alexander would unwittingly become one of the most important figures in the Nuremberg doctors' trial. And he would inadvertently become a central player in one of the most dramatic events in the history of Operation Paperclip. That would take another 7 years. For now, at war's end, Dr. Alexander accepted his orders from Schaeff, boarded a military transport airplane in England, and headed for Germany to begin war crimes investigative work. His first stop was the Dachau concentration camp. Dr. Alexander did not yet know that it was inside Dachau, in the secret barracks called Experimental Cell Block 5, that Luftwaffe doctors had conducted some of the most barbaric and criminal medical experiments of the war. On May 23, 1945, Dr. Alexander, 39, was seated inside an American military transport airplane flying into Munich when approximately 15 miles north of the airport, his plane circled low and he saw the liberated Dachau concentration camp for the first time. Surviving inmates were waving and cheering at the plane, and you could see that two American field hospitals were set up on the camp grounds, Alexander wrote in his journal late at night. American aircraft brought fresh corned beef, potato salad, and real coffee by the ton to the newly liberated prisoners, many of whom were still too weak to leave the camp. The airplanes also brought doctors and nurses with the American Red Cross and the U.S. Army Typhus Commission, and also, on occasion, a medical war crimes investigator like Dr. Alexander. The Dachau concentration camp was the first stop on a long list of Reich medical facilities and institutions that Dr. Alexander was scheduled to visit, locations where medical crimes were suspected of having taken place. With him, Dr. Alexander carried Schaeff instructions that granted him full powers to investigate everything of interest, and also gave him the authority to remove documents, equipment, or personnel as deemed necessary. Fate and circumstance had prepared him for the job. Like Samuel Goudsmit, the scientific director of Operation Alsace, Dr. Alexander had a unique background that qualified him to investigate German doctors and had also made things personal. A Jew, he had once been a rising star among Germany's medical elite. In 1933, Germany's race laws forbade the 28-year-old physician from practicing medicine any longer. Devastated, he left the country and wound up in America. Now, 13 years later, he was back on German soil. His former existence here seemed like a lifetime ago. From as far back as he could remember, Leopold Alexander longed to be a doctor, like his father, Gustav. One of the strongest unconscious motives for becoming a physician was the strong bond of identification with my father, he once said, explaining the pull toward medicine. Gustav Alexander was an ear, nose, and throat doctor in turn-of-the-century Vienna, a distinguished scholar who published more than 80 scientific papers before Leopold was born. His mother, Gisela, was the first woman awarded a PhD in philosophy from the University of Vienna, the oldest university in the German-speaking world. From a young age, Leopold led a charmed life. The Alexanders were sophisticated, wealthy professionals who lived in intellectual bohemian splendor in a huge house with live peacocks on the lawns. Sigmund Freud was a frequent guest, as was the composer Gustav Mahler. By the time Leopold was 15, he was allowed to accompany his father on weekend hospital rounds. The father-son bond grew deep. On weekends, they would walk through Vienna's parks or museums, always engaged in lively conversation about history, anthropology, and medicine, as Dr. Alexander later recalled. In 1929, Leopold Alexander graduated from the University of Vienna Medical School and became a doctor, specializing in the evolution and pathology of the brain. For almost every aspiring physician in Europe at the time, the goal was to study medicine in Germany, and in 1932, Dr. Alexander was invited to enroll at the prestigious Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Brain Research in Berlin. There, he first rubbed elbows with Germany's leading medical doctors, including Karl Kleist, the distinguished professor of brain pathology who would become his mentor. Alexander focused his studies on brain disorders and began fieldwork on patients with schizophrenia. Life was full of promise. Tragedy struck in two cruel blows. In 1932, Gustav Alexander was killed by a former mental patient, murdered in cold blood on the streets of Vienna by a man who 10 years earlier had been hospitalized and declared insane. The second tragedy occurred in January of 1933, when Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. National Socialism was on the rise. For every Jew in Germany, life was about to change inexorably. Fortune blessed Dr. Alexander. On January 20th, 1933, just days before Hitler took power, the ambitious physician prepared to decamp to rural China to study mental illness. "I have accepted an invitation to go for half a year to Beijing Union Medical College in Beijing, China, as an honorary lecturer in neurology and psychiatry," Dr. Alexander wrote to his professors at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, promising to return to Germany by October 1, 1933. It was a promise he was never to fulfill. Within 2 months of Hitler's taking power, the Nazis initiated a nationwide boycott of Jewish doctors, lawyers, and business professionals. This was followed in April 1933 by the Reich's Law for the Restoration of the Professional Civil Service. It was now illegal for non-Aryans to work as civil servants, a ban that included every university teaching position throughout Germany. In Frankfurt, where Dr. Alexander had lived, 69 Jewish professors were fired. The news of Germany's radical transformation reached Dr. Alexander in China. The Alexander family lawyer, Maximilian Friedman, wrote him a letter warning against return. "The prospects in Germany are most unfavorable," Friedman said. And uncle, Robert Alexander, was even more candid about what was happening in Nazi Germany when he wrote to Dr. Alexander to say the nation had succumbed to the swastika. A Jewish colleague and friend, a neurologist named Arnold Mersbach, also penned a letter to Dr. Alexander in despair, telling him that all of their Jewish colleagues in Frankfurt had been dismissed from their university posts. "Our very existences are falling apart," Mersbach wrote. "We are all without hope." For months, Dr. Alexander lived in denial. He clung to the fantasy that Nazi laws would not apply to him, and he vowed to return once his fellowship ended. In China, Dr. Alexander was in charge of the neurological departments of several field hospitals, where he tended to soldiers with head injuries received on the battlefield. ignoring the Nazi mandate that now barred Jews from working as doctors or professors, he wrote a letter to Professor Kleist, his mentor in Germany, saying how much he looked forward to returning home. Kleist wrote back to say that his return to Germany was totally impossible. You, as a Jew, since you have not served as a soldier in the First World War, cannot be state employed. In closing, Kleist wrote, "Have no false hopes." The letter may have saved Dr. Alexander's life. Untethered in China, Alexander was now a nomad, a man without a home to return to. With remarkable ambition and fortitude, he pressed on. As his father had done before him, he wrote and published scientific papers. His were on mental illness, which made him a viable candidate for a fellowship in America. Fortune again favored him when, in the fall of 1933, he learned that he had been awarded a position at a state mental hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts, 50 miles outside Boston. Dr. Alexander boarded an American steamship called President Jackson and set sail for America by way of Japan. Out at sea, a strange event occurred. It happened in the middle of the long journey when his ship was more than 1,000 miles from land. A series of violent storms struck, sending passengers inside for days until finally the weather cleared. On the first clear day, Dr. Alexander ventured outside to play shuffleboard. Gazing out across the wide sea, he spotted an enormous single wave traveling with great speed and force, bearing down on his tiny steamship. There was no escape from what he quickly recognized as a tidal wave. Before Dr. Alexander could run back inside the ship, the President Jackson was lifted up by this great wave. The ship traveled up the steep slope very slowly, further and further, until we finally reached the top, he wrote to his brother Theo. And then, with the ship balancing precariously at the top of the wave, he described the terrifying feeling that followed. Suddenly, there was nothing behind it, nothing but a steep descent. The ship began to freefall. Its nose plunged deep into the water. The impact was harsh. Water splashed to all sides, and things fell to this side and that in the kitchen and common rooms. The ship regained its balance almost effortlessly and steamed on. "The whole thing happened so unbelievably fast," Alexander wrote. "When it was over, I said to myself, 'Now I understand the meaning of the saying, the ocean opens up before you and swallows you whole.'" It did not take long for Dr. Alexander to thrive in America. He was a supremely hard worker. On average, he slept 5 hours a night. Working as a doctor at a New England mental institution was endlessly fascinating to him. He once told a reporter that what interested him most was determining what made men tick. Only a few months after his arrival in New England, he was promoted to a full-time position in the neuropsychiatric ward at Boston State Hospital. While performing hospital rounds in 1934, he met a social worker named Phyllis Harrington. They fell in love and married. By 1938, they had 2 children, a boy and a girl. A prolific writer, Dr. Alexander published 50 scientific papers. By the end of the decade, he'd been hired to teach at Harvard Medical School. He was a U.S. citizen now. Journalists wrote newspaper articles about the doctor from Vienna, citing his outstanding accomplishments in the field of mental illness. He had a new home. He'd been accepted as one of Boston's medical elite. In December 1941, America went to war. Dr. Alexander joined the fight and was sent to the 65th General Hospital in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and then to an army hospital in England. For the duration of the war, Dr. Alexander helped wounded soldiers recover from shell shock. He also collected data on flight fatigue. After the Germans surrendered, he expected to be sent home. Instead, he received his unprecedented order from Schaeff. He was to go to Germany and investigate allegations of Nazi medical crimes. In doing so, he would come face to face with former professors, mentors, and fellow students. It was his job to figure out who might be guilty and who was not. Dr. Alexander's first trip to Dachau did not produce any significant leads, despite rumors that barbaric medical experiments had gone on there. On June 5, 1945, he traveled the 12 miles to Munich to visit the Luftwaffe's Institute for Aviation Medicine. This research